We've just heard a riveting account from Terry Lovelace about this incident at Devil's Den, which is the title of a true story book that he has written. He and his friend Toby are out camping. They encounter this gigantic UFO. They see little creatures zipping around the campsite, and they believe that they slept for 4 hours. Once he gets back, they get back to the base, though. Eventually, they find out a lot of things that had happened during that four-hour period that did not involve sleep. It's a terrifying story, and we'll get to part of that, as well as what Terry remembers from earlier in his life, other incidents that memories of which he had sort of suppressed. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Terry Lovelace, you and Toby get back to the base. You're in bad shape. Your faces are swollen. You're sunburned. You're in pain. You're dehydrated. You need some medical attention. And yeah. You eventually get it, but you have some tough questions to answer about where you'd been and what had happened. So please pick up the story from there.
Yeah, we did. I mean, we both worked in the hospital squadron, so, you know, I mean, hospital people tend to take care of their own, and we were well cared for. And we were given a private room each, and it was curious. The hospital commander came in to talk to me, and he said, "You're to have no contact with Sergeant Tobias, none whatsoever. No, that means no notes, no letters, no phone calls, no contact through third parties. Do you understand me?" And we had a pretty good relationship, but there was that distinction, class distinction between officer and enlisted. And I said, "Yes, sir, I do." But I really didn't understand. But I thought it was an odd request or order, rather. It was definitely an order. And they admitted us both. Like I said, we were in separate rooms, and they were kind enough to keep the lights turned off, the overhead lights, because my eyes were, they called it an arc burn. An arc burn or like a flash burn from a welder's. Hang on just a second.
Sure.
Arc burn from like a welder would get if they didn't have their mask down.
Right.
So, and that's very painful. And with the light, it feels like you got sand in your eyes. It really does. So the third night of my hospitalization, I know I'm going home the next morning. My night nurse comes in with my pain medicine for the night, and I could use it. So she comes in, and as she comes in the door, these two other guys in blue business suits come in with her, follow her in. One guy is shorter, older, maybe 50. The other guys, late 20s, early 30s, they have business suits on, but their suit coats are unbuttoned, and you can see shoulder holsters. They're carrying a pistol. And these guys were cops. I mean, they looked like cops. And, you know, I'd been a straight kid all my life. I had never had any interaction with the police to speak of. I didn't have any legal education at the time, and these guys scared me, and I think that was very intentional. And the guy in charge walks over, and he pulls everything off my tray table. The captain cranks my bed up, so I'm sitting upright, slides the tray table under my chest, and then he flips on the overhead lights. And I'm like, "Sir, could you turn those out? It's killing my eyes." And he had this this thick Louisiana accent. And he's like, "You know, can't work in the dark, son. Got to see what we're doing." I thought, "Oh, man." And then he tells the nurse, if that injection's going to sedate him, it's going to have to wait. So I didn't get my shot. She left the room. And he told her, he says, "Shut the door on your way out," which I thought was rude. So I'm scared. I don't know what, you know, I'm thinking, what kind of trouble am I in? And in my mind, I thought, you know, the worst we could do is a simple trespass. And I asked this guy, I said, sir, am I in some kind of trouble? And he just smiles and he says, son, would we be here if you weren't in trouble? And the captain laughs at that. So they were.
So they're OSI, Office of Special Investigation?
They are. They took out their credentials and showed me. The older guy was a major, and he had the badge and the credentials for USAF, Office of Special Investigations. OSI is to the Air Force what NCIS is to the Navy, if that makes sense to folks. It's the investigative branch. And they pulled up a chair by my head on either side of the bed, and the major starts off by reading me my rights, which I didn't understand. And I was scared to death, and I thought, you know, if I don't want to talk to these guys, it's going to make me look guilty of something, you know? And my mind's racing. What do we do? Do we burn down the forest, you know? And when we left all of our camping stuff there, including Toby's backpack with his camera and all this stuff in it.
My tent. Cooler. Yeah.
We left it at the campsite. We just got in the car and just drove. So my guess is that the park rangers found this chain down and then found our campsite, found Toby's backpack with his address and phone number on it, called the base and said, you know, we got Sergeant Tobias's backpack here. They track him down to the hospital squadron, talk to the hospital commander. Yeah, these guys are camping out there. So the OSI agent wanted to know, well, why did you leave your campsite intact? The only thing I can think of is you guys plan to come back. And he says, what's this all about? You guys got a little marijuana plot growing out there? Is that what this is all about? And that really scared me, because 1977, I mean, that would have been a trip to Leavenworth, you know, that carried a heavy penalty. And what if by chance somebody was growing marijuana out there? You know, they could hang it on us. So I'm really scared, and I think he wanted to scare me. I do.
They start hitting you with all these forms, right? Hey, you need to sign this form. You're basically giving us permission to search anything you have, search your home. You're giving away your rights. We can ask anything we want, right?
Yes. Well, how he led into that was, he says, you know, you boys aren't growing marijuana then? And I said, no, sir, we're not. He says, you don't have a big old bag of marijuana in your house, do you, son? And I said, no, sir, I don't. And he said, well, you don't have any contraband or anything you shouldn't have then, do you? And I said, no, sir. And he said, well, then you wouldn't mind us taking a look around, just to look around. Would that be all right with you? I said, I wasn't about to say no, you know. I mean, I had that right, but I didn't know that at the time. And he laid out six forms in front of me. And the overhead lights are still on. I can hardly see. And I signed six forms. I know I signed an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, which was under duress, and I would fight tooth and nail. And signed a consent form for my home. And the security police showed up at my home like 10 minutes after I signed the form and searched my house. The only thing they took was from my dark room. I had some pictures I'd taken of the moon. Because, like I say, on a sack base, there's not much you can photograph anyway. And I had a telephoto lens, and I was taking some pictures of the moon and developing them. And for some reason, they found those interesting and took them.
You start telling them, these inquisitors, you tell them parts of the story. Sounds like you didn't tell them all the details. And they start
Absolutely not.
Yeah. They start focusing on photographs, right?
What's that?
They start focusing on photographs, whether you took any photos, where the photos. That seems to be their central point of inquiry.
It becomes that, yes. And these guys, he pulled the when the captain left, the major stayed, and the nurse came in. I got my shot. She left. And then the captain left right behind her, and it was just me and the major in the room. And the major shut the door, and he was situated such that he had his hand against the door. And he bent over my face, and he kind of dropped the tough guy affect and just looked like a regular human being again. And he says, "Son, I know, and you know, you two knuckleheads stumbled onto something out there, didn't you? And I think you know what I mean, don't you?" And I didn't say a word. The last thing in the world I was going to do is say, "Yeah, I saw a UFO the size of Walmart." I mean, I would have been in a psych ward. You know, our story was, we went to bed, we woke up sick as dogs, we came home. That's it. And that's the story I stood by. And so he says to me, "You know, I know and you know." Somehow he knew. I mean, this guy knew. And he says, "All I want to know is how many pictures you took of it, and where's your camera, and where's your film?" And I said, "Sir, I never took a single picture."
Looking back on it now, do you think that when they came into the room, they already knew what you had seen out there?
No question. No question about that. You know, when the major stayed in the room and told me, "I know and you know, it was understood. And I want to know how many pictures you took of it, I-T, it. Huh. And the only it in my life for it was what we saw out at Devil's Den.
I'm going to fast forward a little bit. Eventually, they come up with their own lie detector system. You offered to take a test, but they come up with their own. They said, "Yeah, we've got our own lie detector system." You go into a room, get shot up with some drugs, and then get put under hypnosis, at least partial hypnosis. You tried to stay lucid and control the narrative, but they got a lot of information about the encounter you had out there, and you came to understand. Yeah.
I could resist the hypnosis. I mean, I knew that I couldn't be hypnotized against my will, but the drug I knew I had no control over. The drug, by the way, was sodium amytal, or so I'm told. Since I published the book, I put my email address in the back. I've got letters from people who were in the Air Force who told me that, you know, the OSI did this and the drug used was sodium amytal, and other people have had this experience as well. So, yeah, I was in an interrogation room, and they gave me the drug, and it was a flush. And it was actually a very pleasant feeling. And this guy, he was a major without a name tag. And he carried himself more like a therapist than he did a military officer. And he's running me through this hypnosis thing. And he's walking me downstairs, you know, and mentally, take the first step, feeling relaxed. Take the second step, feeling twice as relaxed. You know, he had a real smooth voice, like a radio announcer, and it was easy to listen to. And in my mind's eye, I went up the stairs, and I played. I tried to compartmentalize my head and not surrender my whole mind to this guy. And that partially worked, because one of his first questions was, he says, "You and Sergeant Tobias went on a little camping trip, didn't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "And you saw some funny lights in the sky, didn't you?" I said, "Yes." And he says, "But they weren't funny lights, were they, Terry?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Who were they, Terry?" And I said, "They were the space people, the star people." And I thought, my God, did that just come out of my mouth? And I had no control over it.
I was trying to tell from that chapter where you're describing this exchange how much of what is going on, the story that's coming back to you, is in your head and how much you shared with them. Did you eventually tell them the full story of what had happened during those 4 hours when you thought you were sleeping?
Yeah, you know, at no time was I able to pull up a clear linear memory of everything that happened, but what this guy did was, with the help of this drug or something, or partial hypnosis, I don't know, he was able to have me recall this stuff, and I could see it in my mind's eye. I mean, I could see it. And he walked me through, you know, what did he do to you? Where did you go? What was the inside of the ship like? You know, well, he starts off, you know, did they take you? Yes, you know, yes, Brad, they took us. And these are memories I don't think I would have had. I think they would have been buried in my subconscious had not I had this session. And had I not been so determined that, you know, I wasn't going to lose these memories. You know, but I felt like these memories belonged to me. This was an experience that I had. And I don't want somebody to make me forget it, wipe the slate clean. You know, I want to keep these memories.
But they tried. I mean, what comes next? We can get into that later. But they gave you drugs that were definitely having an effect on your memory and Toby's memory. And I'd like you to take us through a little bit, 2 minutes or so, of what fragments of memory came back about being on that ship. You were taking on board that giant craft.
We were. I have a distinct memory of standing inside the thing, and they had taken our clothes off. And I had my boots and my clothing in my arms, and Toby's standing next to me. And I'm looking around. The only thing I can move is my eyes. I'm like frozen. And all I can move is my eyes. So my eyes are darting around, and I'm trying to take in as much of this place as I can. And the amazing thing was, as big as this thing looked like from the outside, it looked twice as big inside. It was just enormous. Everything was white or stainless steel, and the inside of the thing was insanely brightly lit. You know, it was like they had 500-watt bulbs and, you know, everywhere. I didn't see a light fixture. Light just emanated from the walls, from the ceiling. It was just incredibly bright. I think that's what hurt my eyes. And I remember standing there, and I heard a woman screaming. And then I realized that Toby was gone, and I heard him screaming, "Oh, my God, oh, my God." And I knew it was going to be my turn soon. And I'm looking around, and there are these little gray guys. They're running around all over the place, but, I mean, they're moving with purpose. They're doing things. And I saw a figure who was about 6 foot tall and chalkish pink complexion, not gray, who seemed to be in charge. I mean, he carried himself with an air of authority. And I'm straining my eyes to the left, and he just happens to turn his head in my direction, and we locked eyes. And the second we locked eyes, this guy was in my head. I mean, George, he was in my head. He knew me, he knew my wife, he knew my secrets, he knew everything about me. And all I got back from the eyes was just raw intellect, not an ounce of empathy or mercy or anything. And that scared me. That exchange with him had been the substance of my nightmares for 40 years, walking through that scenario. I also noticed that there were a group of people standing to my right, to our right. We were segregated from them, but there were a group of, and they were, it was difficult to tell because my sight was so limited, but I'd say there were 20 people or more, and they were in the same situation we were, and they were a mixed bag of men, women, and children, and they're holding their clothing in their hand.
I'll tell you what, Terry, we're going to have to take another short break. When we come back, you can share the story with us about the other people who were on board this craft when you were taken into it. Terry Lovelace is sharing some pretty harrowing details about his experience. There's a lot more still to come about the things that happened to he and his friend and other humans on board this ship. And as Terry has learned over the years, that he's had multiple contacts with these creatures. They have an ongoing interest in them, and it's had health consequences for him that continue to this day. We'll get more of the story and then take a couple of your calls right after this on Coast to Coast AM. So, Terry, you are taken on this ship with your friend. You get on there, and you can see there are other people who are in the same predicament you're in. You make contact with this being that seems to be able to see through you. Is it the same being that has sort of paid you visits through your life?
Not this one, no. I saw him once in my life and, you know, 100 times in my dreams. But, you know, on board the ship, there were a lot of things that scared me, but this guy really, really scared me. I wanted nothing to do with him.
There was something else weird that you saw on the ship that you describe in the book. I'm trying to get my head around it. It was like an aquarium with some very strange specimens inside.
Yeah, as we walked down a corridor, we actually didn't walk. We were like on a motorized walkway, and we were still frozen. I could only move my eyes. But as we were going down this corridor, I could see this row of aquariums, different sizes. And they had inside them, at various stages of development, what I thought to be puppies, because they had folds of skin. And but I mean, they were small. They weren't. They didn't look like dogs yet. They looked like puppies. And as I'm walking past, and as I'm passing them in this hallway, my eyes are to the right. I'm trying to drink in as much of it as I can. And one of them opens an eye and scares me. I don't know. I don't know what these things were or what they would mature into. And there were some larger tanks that would accommodate a full, but they were empty.
And so what did they want from you?
Well, they took me into the examination room. And I was frozen like a plank of wood. And the gray guys put me on this table. And they were doing something to my lower back. Me, from my position with my head back, I could see this tall, insectoid-looking thing that looked like, for all the world, like a praying mantis. Now, in my mind's eye, I see him in a white lab coat. And I don't think he was wearing a white lab coat. And there's this bright light above me. And we're back. And it hurt. I mean, it really hurt. And I'm screaming. And I'm filling my lungs with air, and I'm screaming as loud as I can. And I can't hear a thing. And I'm panicked, and I'm screaming. And I think my screaming annoyed this thing. And it turned its big triangular-shaped head in my direction, and I heard with crystal clarity in my head, "Why are you screaming? Stop screaming. You know we don't hurt you. You know we take you back. Now stop screaming." And he tapped me on the forehead, and I was out. And that was the last memory I had of the ship.
He was telling you, "You've done this before."
That's the implication, yeah.
And, of course, in the book, we don't need to dwell on it. We want to save some stuff for people to read it. But you've had a lifetime of these experiences, and many of the memories they're daylight memories. They're not just nightmares, which you had those as well, night terrors. You have awake memories of encounters and sightings.
Yeah. I've been tested twice and diagnosed this with PTSD. And this is the only traumatic event I've had in my life. I mean, you know, everybody has traumatic events in their life, but this is the major, major trauma I experienced in my lifetime. And, yeah, I've been diagnosed with PTSD twice, and I'm told that I called them intrusive thoughts. They call them flashbacks. I'll be doing something in the middle of reading a book or doing something, and then the thoughts will just enter my mind, and there's no control over that. And I'm told that that's normal with PTSD.
I had read something about your health, a tremendous weight loss.
Is it
in response to something that happened?
You know, I lost the weight as I wrote the book and had the intention to publish it and speak openly about it. And my weight dropped from, I put on some weight because I quit running, and my weight was up to 220, 240 maybe even, and my weight got down to 139 pounds, and issues of tissue wasting, I got so thin. I've since put on some weight, and I'm back up to about 180 now. So, you know, I feel quite a bit better. But that was a slow process.
You didn't get court-martialed. You didn't get in a lot of trouble with the military eventually, but they did keep an eye on you for a while, right?
Yeah, I think so. I do. And, you know, at the end of this interrogation, the hypnotist guy says that, Terry, you've got all these ugly memories, and I'm going to take them from you. And at the count of three, I'm going to take them away, and they'll be gone forever. They'll be gone for good. And I thought, you know, no way am I going to let you do this. And I don't know. You know, maybe I should have let this guy erase my mind. I don't know. But I don't think so. I think that had he done that, I think that it would have bubbled up and seeped through and maybe manifest in some unhealthy way. I think it was better to have kept the memories.
And you got hints throughout the that interrogation and the hypnosis session. You had hints from, based on comments you could overhear, that they've done this before, that this is not their first rodeo.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, the captain, after they had me walk down this flight of imaginary stairs, the hypnotist gave me a command. He said, I want you to reach up and turn on a light. There's a chain hanging there. Reach up and turn on that light so we can see. And I waited to see it voluntarily move, and it didn't. And I'm in this slumped kind of, you know, resting position. And he said more forcefully, do it, Terry, reach up and turn on that light. And I did, but I did it voluntarily. I did it on my own volition. I reached up and pulled an imaginary chain. I thought, yeah, I'm pulling your chain, all right. And yeah, the captain said, you know, are you sure he's under? And the hypnotist, I thought, what arrogance. He says, yeah, he was gone by the count of three. And there was one point where I was describing some humans that were on board the ship that wore tan flight suits. And these guys were human beings, at least six of them, five men and a woman. And they were as human as anybody. They were young like us at the time. They had military haircuts, like I said, tan flight suits with orange insignias that I couldn't make out. But I could see their boots clearly. Their boots looked like issue military combat boots to me. And they completely ignored us, would not look in our direction. And I believe that they were crew members. And when I said that, the captain came out with an expletive. And that seemed to strike a nerve. There was some shuffling of papers, and the hypnotist said, you know, you'll forget that memory, Terry. That never happened. You know, there were no men on board with orange flight suit.
So is your, what's your guess there, that they were humans who had went over to the other side, or they were hybrids who just looked like humans?
Boy, they sure looked human. I mean, they looked like healthy 19, 20-year-old kids. And my guess is, I don't know, they were part of the crew.
You had one other encounter that you talk about in Incident at Devil's Den. It happened, I think, at a theater, you and your wife, or you encounter a female, right?
When we went shopping?
Shopping, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That goes back to some of the phobias I have. You know, I mentioned I don't like to walk across open space. When we went to the mall, this was 1987, and it was Christmas time, and I'm walking down the mall, walking around with my wife, just chatting, turned a corner, and there were these naked mannequins in a storefront window, and they were, it was a woman's clothing store, and they were just from the waist up, and they were all in the window there, but they had no clothing on, and I saw these naked mannequins, and for some reason, that freaked me out. I just wigged out. I couldn't, and still today, I don't feel comfortable looking at them. I think it reminds me too much of the pink guy with the chalky complexion I ran into, or something. It triggers something, like panic. And we left the mall. Arizona.
I'm going to take one call, and then we'll come back. I had a couple other questions to ask. East of the Rockies, Ron in North Carolina. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
All right.
Ron?
It's great to talk to you. I got a question for you, Terry. You said you walked past these aquariums where they looked like puppies. Were there water inside them?
Yes. Once it had puppies inside them, there was pinkish water inside them. And fluid.
I was in the Coast Guard. I had a couple of experiences I'd like to talk to you about. I actually was a ready-man aboard a Coast Guard cutter out in the middle Atlantic Ocean. And also, when we got in port back in the early 1970s, 72 or whatever, and I was encountered with these men in black, which back then I never even heard of men in black. And it was a long story I'd like to tell you sometime.
Well, what kind of account are you talking about?
Yeah.
Well, okay, we had UFOs right above us. It came down and that. We had took pictures. A friend of mine had telephoto lenses. There were beings inside this thing, evidently looking down. It would go up, come down, do 90 degrees. It was like trying to show off to us. I'm the one, the radio man, that was sent the message to Washington, D.C. When we pulled into port, there were 140 men aboard the ship. About 100 of us saw it because the rest of them were on duty. And here's something really ironic. I've never found anybody to uphold this other crewman that would say this, come out and say what I'm saying. And I mean, I would take a polygraph. There's nothing that I'm lying about. I'm just crazy. I mean, why nobody else has come? I do remember some of the officers' names, and I could always find who's on board. But when we got back into port in Yankee Pier in Governor's Island, New York, this two or three limos were sitting on the dock, which is fully unusual.
Hey, Ron, we can't hear you. You're gonna
Latin in black with the black hats and the glasses. Came on board, and we were interrogated. We were not allowed off the ship until we signed these affidavits saying we never saw nothing. And these men looked like regular men, but they were robotic. They had no weren't talking like normal people would. And it's a story I like to tell you.
Hey, Ron, what year? What was the name of the ship? What year did this happen, and where were you?
Okay, the Coast Guard cutter Spencer, Rick 36 of Trinity. Weatherhine Burns Cutter 36. There's a new Spencer. This is the older one. It's commissioned in 1936. We were out off against Ocean Station Echo, which was the waters were calm. It was at night. It had like general course went off. And I was in my bunk, and they said, you know, come up on board and take a look at this. Oh, and the MST guy who had this Olympus state of the art camera and everything. The telephoto lenses and everything. We were taking pictures of it, and I saw the pictures. We developed the next day. But we got on board, everything was confiscated from him, everything. Pictures, cameras, and of course, they never gave him anything back board.
I'll tell you what was the date? What do you think the date was? Hello?
What year?
Yeah, I can't understand you. You got to put the phone up to your mouth. What year?
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, the Coast Guard Cutter Spencer, Rick 36W, which means weather high endurance cutter.
I'll tell you what, Ron, we're having a hard time understanding you. I'm going to ask you, maybe you could email the information to Terry. I think he'd like to hear about it, and I would too, if you could share it with us. Thanks for the call, Ron. Appreciate it. Terry, with you, has the activity all ended? Are they still interested in you?
You know, the activity was at at zero, almost, for a long time. But when I started writing this book, activity kicked up again. And I know this sounds really cliche, and it's almost embarrassing to even say it because it sounds so cliche, but it's true. And I've got many, many photographs to prove it. I published the book March of 2018, and by May of 2018, I had helicopters over my house. Cutting donuts around my house. And I went outside and I'm looking, and I took pictures of them. I have a good friend, Bruce Solheim, Dr. Bruce Solheim. He's a professor of history and a former helicopter pilot. And I sent the photos to him, and he was able to help me identify. Some were military, some were commercial, but none of them had any markings on them. Lawyer, what I did, first thing I did was, you know, hey, these things got to have some kind of marking. I looked up the codified federal regulation. It says that, you know, helicopters have to display the letter N, like Nancy, on the side, then with the numerical sequence identifying the craft. And these things had no markings on them. And the pilots wore helmets, which was significant. I found out from Dr. Bruce that only military pilots wear helmets. Civilian pilots shun them and don't wear helmets. So for some reason, the military was buzzing my house.
You also, so you discovered the metal thing. We started the conversation tonight about the metal piece that was in your leg, and that kind of got the ball rolling. In 2012, you have an experience where you have an encounter with a female MIB, Betty. We're not going to have time to tell that whole story, but after that encounter and an exchange of information, you have a conversation with this being from somewhere else who's wearing a human clothing and a wig.
Yes.
You are told it's going to go away. They don't want you taking it out. They're not going to allow you to carve it out of there and have a piece of proof of something. So they let you know they're going to take it.
Fall into the hands of terrestrial scientists were the exact words she used.
And they were good to their word, weren't they?
They sure were.
All right. The next time you come back, we'll have you tell that part of the story. Terry Lovelace, it was great to have you on. I've been looking forward to this, and I hope people will check out Incident at Devil's Den. It's a terrific read and really chilling. You know, we think we know about alien abductions, what the scenario is like. This really personalizes it in a way that few books ever have done. So thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Appreciate
All right.
your time. Thank you very much.
All right. We have links to Terry's work on the Coast to Coast site. I want to say also to Marin Rudnick and his book, Intersect. Check that out as well. Thanks to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Michael Cosio and Gina Salvati, our webmaster, Greg Bishop, Dan Galante, Chris Boros. Merry Christmas, everyone. I'll talk to you next year. Good night.